Welcome to Woman Today, a magazine program designed to encourage and equip women today for a better tomorrow, together. Hi there, my name is Larice Faree and I serve as a presenter at Good News Community Radio in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. I believe that we do life and faith better together. So today I'm excited to introduce Kelly Needham, author of Purpose Fooled, Why Chasing Your Dreams, Finding Your Calling, and Reaching for Greatness Will Never Be Enough. Kelly will help us to recognize the flaws in our pursuit of purpose and redirect our hearts to the person that we were truly made for. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us this morning. First off, I want to start by just touching on the title of your book, Purpose Fooled. And I want to ask, is it an indication that you sort of propose that it's foolish to try and live a purposeful life?
Actually, no. My hope with that title was to communicate that I think we have been fooled in what we think gives us purpose and meaning. I actually think we were made for deeply purposeful lives. I think the desire for a life filled with purpose and meaning is actually God-given. I think it's an essential need in some ways, but by and large, the way that we are told how to achieve that purpose, I think is flawed. And I think we're just deceived sometimes so that we've been fooled, if that makes sense, when it comes to our understanding of our purpose.
I want to ask why you think the discussion on purpose is so popular both inside and outside of the church, because it's just interesting to me that there's very little that we agree on with the secular world. You know, there's very little common ground, but it seems that whichever side you are, this concept of living a purposeful life is really popular even in the secular world. So why would you say, what do you think it is about us as humans that just need to live a purposeful life?
I think that if you look back at the origin story of humanity, back even in Genesis and the Garden of Eden, it says that Adam and Eve were made in the very image of God. So we were made, our existence is connected to the eternal, incomparable, uncontainable person of God. I think that's where this deep desire for something transcendent comes. The author of Ecclesiastes will say it this way, that eternity is written on man's hearts, or on men's hearts. So we are limited. We know that we die. We have a limited amount of days in our life, but we ache for kind of something bigger than that. And I think that's tied to our very design. Now, what's interesting is the culture around us, by and large, has tried to totally get rid of anything sacred. There's a lot of kind of, oh, you could choose to worship something if you want, but you don't need that. We've kind of gotten away from gods and, you know, things bigger than us. And so what, ironically about that, you've kind of cut the cord that connects you to purpose when you do that, because I think that deep ache for purpose is connected to a God bigger than us and outside of us. And so what I find interesting about the secular world, the non-Christian world, is they've separated themselves from a sacred being, right, bigger than them, outside of them. And that has produced this problem of, well, then what even was I made for? You know, what why am I even here then? And we try to chase achievement and all these things, but it's exhausting. And so I actually read a lot of books and research for this one that were secular books about this. And it's interesting that there's a lot of critique going on about that. There's actually a few authors I read that are calling people back to the gods and kind of like pick and choose whatever God you want, but you need a God in your life if you're going to have a life that's meaningful. And I find that really interesting. So I think that's why you see the secular world struggling with purpose is they've separated themselves from God and something bigger than themselves. And I think in the Christian space too, sometimes what we do is we're just using God to achieve some sense of purpose for ourselves. I want to do big things for God. You know, in that sentence, I'm still the protagonist. I'm the hero. I'm the one giving my life meaning. God's just the vehicle by which I do that. And still, that is a perversion of our original design. No, God is the hero. He is the one that is the protagonist in the story. And I'm made in his image. Mm. I am secondary to him. And if I'll embrace that role, my life actually fills with meaning. Mm. So I know that was a long answer, but I think that's why we're both struggling. Mm. Both sides of the fence are struggling with that issue.
It's quite interesting. If you think about a evolutionary perspective and you consider that it's wildly believed that we are just a big chance, you know, everything just came about by chance. It's quite interesting that the need for purpose can actually be a testimony to the reality of something greater and beyond us. Because technically, if everything just happened to, you know, coming to existence totally by chance, there is no greater purpose. So why would we have evolved to desire deeply the sense of purpose to such an extent that we almost can't function if we don't have some idea of our purpose? So it's really interesting how, as you put it, the author of Ecclesiastes says that God has put this in our hearts, you know, such a testimony that there is a God. And you can't deny that if you see the craving for purpose. What would you say is the pressure of society that is placed on us when our purpose is totally left up to us? Like if we have to sort of determine our own purpose in life, what do you see are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, it is. It's actually so much pressure. I don't know how many people have really identified it, but if purpose is totally left up to you, I have to now figure out what I was made for. And then I have to go achieve it. That's a lot of work. You first have the work of, I've got to figure out what do I do with my life. That gives me the workload of like this endless self-discovery. I have to constantly be looking inside me. What do I want to do? What am I good at? And a little bit of that can be healthy, but we're kind of left to just look at that. And then now we have technology that's allowed us the opportunity to do all sorts of things. We could do almost anything. We could start a podcast. We could start a YouTube channel. We could start a business or a nonprofit or, you know, things that other generations didn't even have the option to do. So we're left with just endless amounts of opportunity, self-exploration. And then once we finally decide and make a decision about, here's what's going to give my life meaning, now we have to go achieve it and work hard at it. It's just really a life that has no rest in it and no space for rejuvenation, leisure, play, fun things, rest. There's no space left for that because we have to be busy fighting for this purpose that we have in our life versus what the Bible teaches. I was made for God. He is my purpose. Which means even in moments of rest, I've not lost a sense of purpose and identity. Even in moments of sickness or where I'm suffering or I don't have much to contribute, I exist as an image bearer for him and I live my life with him and for him. I don't have to do the work anymore of creating meaning. It's given to me in my very existence if I will just receive it and embrace it. And then I get to live the life that he has set before me. Now, that's the language that Hebrews 12 uses. Run the race that's set before you. It doesn't say run the race you picked out for yourself. Run the race that you decided you should run because it's the best one to give you the most amount of meaning. It just says run the race that has been set before you. There are obligations set before you to love God and love others. Do that with him. And that infuses life with meaning. It's actually way more restful. And purpose actually comes sooner versus feeling like, I've got years to now figure out what am I good at? What should I do? What opportunities? Maybe one day I'll achieve it. Purpose always feels way far out there. I'll finally feel purposeful once I can do all of that work. So it sounds glamorous in one sense, but the reality is it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. And I do think people are feeling that exhaustion and burnout, mm-hmm. and then slipping into, you know, hopelessness and depression, because then they get tired of working for purpose. And then they're just like, well, I guess my life just won't be purposeful. Mm-hmm. And so just zone out on social media or, you know, whatever I need to do to numb myself. So I think that's, you're seeing both things, right? Anxiety, exhaustion, but also then people falling into hopelessness and despair because it just feels too hard sometimes.
Mm. It's such a fearful way to live your life. I think it's really a fearful way because there's no security when you are the determiner of your own purpose, because whatever it is you decide will be your purpose in life can probably be taken away from you like within a day. So that's quite
absolutely
scary.
Which one of us doesn't have circumstances that have the potential to strip us from our ability to contribute or do what we would like to do? And that does make life feel very scary. We find ourselves clinging to particular tasks with all our might, you know, and then creating unhealth sometimes for ourselves because of that, you know, not, you know, valuing the relationships that really give life and health to us, our familial relationships, those around us, because we're clinging so tightly. We can't lose this thing because it holds our purpose. Because again, I think you need purpose to live. I think there's studies and research shown that we really do as human beings need a sense of my life has purpose and meaning. We need that to thrive. And so if you assign that purpose, if you locate it in a particular task or thing, you're kind of signing up for life to always be enslaved to that type of work. And then if it ever is removed from you for one reason or another, you will feel terrified. Mm-hmm. Like the rug has been pulled out from underneath you because this thing you need to live, to thrive, is now gone. And so it is, it's a very precarious situation to be in that doesn't give you rest and always kind of leaves you with a lingering fear of what might happen.
Kelly, what do you think is the link between purpose and identity? Because I just feel that one of the reasons purpose is such a major conversation within and outside of the church is because we link so much of who we are to our purpose. Can you unpack some of that for us?
Yeah, I think that we do culturally now in the church and outside of the church link our identity to what we do. We see our life tied to our activities. But really, if you think about the word purpose, what does it mean? You know, if I were to say, what is the purpose of my car? The purpose of my car, we're talking about its existence. It's very DNA. Why does it exist? It exists to get me from point A to point B faster than walking. Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of my coffee cup? It's to keep hot liquid in it, sort of warm, and not burn my hand. Like the way it's designed is for hot liquids. Okay, that's what it's for. So when we say, what is my purpose as a person, we really are talking about what is my reason for existence? What is my function? And that really, I think, is a different way to talk about identity. Mm-hmm. Who am I? At my core, what am I? Who am I? What is my function in the world? So in some ways, I think whatever you do tie your purpose to will be what you what becomes your identity. And so if I say, for example, I think my purpose is to write books. My purpose is to be a writer, that I see unique gifting in myself for that and opportunity for that. And God seems to be using it, which I'd say all those things are true. But if I make that my purpose, that is why I exist. Mm. That becomes the very core of who I am. And now writing is what gives me joy. Writing is what gives me meaning. Writing is now something I need to do to feel a sense of like, this is who I am. If it ever gets stripped from me, if I ever in old age get dementia and I can't write, or I, you know, something else is happening, I will feel a sense of shakenness at my core of who I am because I have said, this is my purpose. So I really think that, you know, sometimes when I talk to the Christians, like, well, it's just semantics here, you know, what we call our purpose. And I would say it maybe is just semantics, but I think it matters because what you tell yourself is your purpose is what you will identify yourself by. Mm. Where again, the Bible, I think, tells us my purpose is not a set of tasks or actions. My purpose is a person, that my very purpose in life is God, not doing things for God, not even living for God. I just exist for him. I am an image bearer of him. My literal existence is meant to be like a mirror reflecting his glory. That's what it means to be an image bearer. I am not the image. I just showcase the image, the one that I am made in his image. And that if I tell myself that and I think and talk like that, now my purpose is God. He may give me specific things to do, like writing books, but that's not what my purpose is. My purpose is him. And that then frees me to be able to weather the changes in my life in seasons of writing or not. It's like there are tasks I like more than other tasks, and that's okay. It's okay to have seasons where you're doing things that aren't your favorite, but I can do those things without losing my sense of identity. I can go through job changes or season changes that aren't my favorite because in all those spaces, I'm still the Lord's. Mm. And that's why I'm made. That's my very existence and nature and purpose in breathing is so that I could reflect him to the world. And I can do that laying in a bed in a hospital, and I can do that writing books, and I can do that changing diapers, and I can do that calling my mother-in-law, and I can do that, you know, I can do that in anything. Mm-hmm. And so it does ground my sense of identity to something bigger than my circumstances or even my activities and what I do or what I don't do, whether I'm working or resting. My identity stays grounded outside of that when I can remember my purpose is not a task. My purpose is a person, and he's with me all the time. And so it may be just semantics to some people, but I think they matter. Mm-hmm. I think the language we use matters for the reason you're talking about. We will tie our identity to whatever we tell ourselves is our purpose.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, would you mind getting into some of the backstory sort of to the book and explaining to the listeners how you sort of got onto this topic, why you initially became interested in it, and then how did the Lord teach you personally these lessons in your life that you were then able to share in this book?
Yeah, this is something I've been wrestling with for many years, actually. When I was in my early 20s, I was married. We got married very young. And my husband was a singer-songwriter and touring artist signed to a record label in Nashville. And so the first, you know, 10 years of our life together was really defined by his music career. And it was amazing. God used his songs and his teaching to change a lot of lives. You know, people would come up to me every night, "Your husband's music has changed my life," and, you know, tell me all these testimonies. And it was great. But for me, I was doing a lot of the behind the scenes work. I was booking flights and hotel rooms, and I was ordering merchandise, CDs, and I was folding T-shirts, and I was training people how to use our credit card machine. And I was playing violin at times as background instrumentalist to his music. And it just felt like, well, he seems to have the really meaningful work, and I have the the ugly stepsister work, you know, that like somebody has to do it, but it doesn't really feel like it's contributing that much to people's lives. You know, I had within my own heart a desire for like, I want to preach the gospel to people too. I don't want to just be backstage, you know, doing like these administrative tasks that are boring. So, you know, it was in that season that I really was wrestling with God and asking him a lot of big questions. And I have 5 kids now. And so there's been other seasons since then of motherhood where I've had multiple kids in diapers and just the same thing. I've always wanted to be a mom, but man, when you're living in the middle of a whole lot of mundane, repetitive work, it does feel, it can feel very purposeless. You know, in your head, this matters, these children matter, but it just doesn't seem significant yet. And it was in those seasons that I finally got bold enough to really bring my honest questions to God. I think for a while, you know, we tend to go, this is what I should say to God. We have kind of a nice Christian exterior, but I began to come to him with, okay, Lord, you put these desires in my heart to like do big things for you. And it seems like you're sitting me on the bench on the sidelines a lot. And I don't know what to do with that. And what do you have to say about that? And then I just would take my Bible and read through all of it with that lens. I want to know what you have to say about these things. And so I was bringing my real honest thoughts to him and wanting to hear from him. And it was so, what I found on the other side of that wrestle with him was so much freedom and actually a life that felt so much more purposeful than what I was living. I was assigning purpose to like these little tiny slivers of things. Oh, when I get to teach the Bible from stage. Mm. Oh, when I get to write blogs. Like I had these little pockets of my life that felt meaningful, and everything else kind of was like frustrating and annoying and like, gosh, when can I get away from these seasons? And as I wrestled with God through these things, it began to be clear to me that, God doesn't despise my desire to do great things. He doesn't despise my desire to be seen or to make an impact. He actually wants those things for me as well. His definitions are just different than mine. Mm. And what he sees as greatness is different than what I see as greatness. What he sees as true impact is different than me. And as I began to receive his definitions instead of mine, it was like all of life now exploded into color.
Mm.
All of it was meaningful. All of it has the potential for eternal impact. And all of it is significant because I was starting to see with his lens and his perspective. And it's been really stabilizing and liberating to be able to like do an interview with you, for example, which feels out of the ordinary, right? And significant. Like how many of my friends are at the end of the day, we're texting each other, hey, I did an interview today. I'm one of the only ones who's saying that. But then I'm also going to go fold a couple of batches of laundry today, you know? So it's like, I can do both things and see them both as equally significant if it's what God has set before me, and equally potentially impactful. And I don't even know how and why. He just says that if I abide with him, my life will bear fruit. And that if I don't, it is nothing. That's from John 15. So this has been a personal wrestle of mine for a long time that's ended in a lot of joy and freedom, which is why I wrote the book. I wanted that same liberty and relief and joy for other people.
I think you bring out an interesting distinction there when you mention that both the big and the small tasks are equally significant and important, because I know in the book you also say that there was a stage where you sort of made the opposite assumption, and you know, the Lord gave you contentment in the mundane activity, but then you sort of got a wrong perspective on the big tasks, you know, and their significance. Could you share some of that for any of our listeners who may hear this and go, well, I don't need to be doing big things because obviously they aren't important, it's the mundane. If you could just unpack that, please.
Yeah, that's a I think a lot of books that are on Christian shelves right now are kind of swinging back and forth between those two things. You know, there's books that are like, do big things for God, and then do small things for God, you know, and we're kind of pitting those two things against each other. And I did do that. I think being married to Jimmy and watching his career take off, I had this longing for the big things. Well, put me on stage too, because I have something to say. And then God really ushered me into a season of when he was helping me see his own definitions of greatness and impact. And I really was seeing, wow, so much of that's happening in the small, that I went, all right, that I'm such a rule follower. Great. We're going to do small then. And I'm just no more public ministry, because obviously that was really prideful of me that I was just trying to, like, you know, do what I wanted to do for the Lord. And I did feel, I think there was healthy repentance there, but then I was like, well, just write it all off. And I did. I deleted a lot of my social media at the time. And I was, you know, somebody asked me to speak somewhere and I just said, no, I don't do that anymore. And it was really Jimmy who challenged me that I had made an unhealthy, distinction between those things, as if things that are big platforms and stages are somehow worse than the small. It's like, no, God can use both. And he regularly took his people in the scriptures to both places to make an impact for him. You see men like Abraham who really wander their whole lives. He has a child in old age, but he dies before he even sees his grandson. So it's like, that doesn't feel like that most of his life experientially would have been pretty ordinary. But then you have men like Joseph and David who have just everybody, you know, he's at the top of leadership in Egypt, Joseph is. And then David is a king that like everybody knows. And regularly people are wondering, when are we going to have a king like David again? So both are valuable. I think the key is the one who's making those distinctions, who's going to be on big platforms or in small spaces or both. God is doing that. God is the orchestrator behind those things. He is the one lifting people up and hiding them. And in both places, he's moving and working in huge, significant ways. But neither, they're both in some ways kind of neutral. I think that the temptation for us is to locate meaning, put meaning in a location on stages behind microphones and go, oh, that's meaningful. Or to locate it in a home. Oh, it's right here behind the scenes. It's like, meaning is where God is, where you're walking obediently with God. He is the source of meaning, and where he goes, we should go. I mean, this is what, why I think John the Baptist is heralded by Jesus as the greatest man who ever lived, because he did both. He had a, you know, ministry just exponentially growing. Everyone in Israel knows him and is coming to him to be baptized before Jesus comes on the scene. So he's famous, well-known, preaching, like very visible ministry. And obviously God is in that. And then when Jesus comes on the scene, his ministry goes into decline. Everybody leaves his ministry to follow Jesus. And then he's imprisoned and later beheaded. So then he has this sharp downturn into obscurity. And no one's talking about him anymore. They're talking about Jesus. So it's not that he's totally forgotten about, but by and large in the New Testament, John the Baptist's name fades into the background. And in that moment when he's confronted about it, his response to his own disciples is, amen, as it should be. I'm not the bridegroom. I'm just a friend of his. And if you need, essentially his posture is, do you need me to be on stage and like, you know, preaching to everybody? Great. I'm there, Lord. Do you need me to be in the background? Amen. I'm there too. Whatever you need from me, my identity is tied to you. My purpose is tied to you. And my sense of meaning is tied to you. And I'm fully at your disposal. And you need me in big places, small places, either. I'm good. And I think that's really at the heart of why Jesus would say of him, of men born among women, no one is greater than John, because of that heart disposition. So that was something that I kind of swung the pendulum way too far into the ordinary. And then the Lord had to bring me back to go, no, that's not the problem. The problem is your heart in it, you know. And then when your heart is right with me, then you're free to go anywhere with me. And, you know, it's okay to like one more than the other. But I think if my purpose is tied to the very person of Jesus, it liberates me from holding too tightly to either thing as a safe place or a place of meaning. My place of meaning is him wherever I go.
And I think ultimately it's true that both the mundane and the extraordinary work that we are involved in are equally significant in God's kingdom because of the thesis of your book, which is that our purpose is not found in our verbs, whether they be big or small, but it is found in God himself. I want to ask if you could unpack the heart of your thesis of the whole book, and then help us to see how we are supposed to be person-centered in our purpose rather than verb-centered.
That is a hard lesson. I'll just heads up. We were made for a person. And I think the way that, so that is the thesis of the book. I'm not made for verbs. I'm made for a noun. I'm not made for tasks. I'm made for a person. And that's almost impossible for us to fully understand in the current culture we live in. As I interviewed people for this book, I would share that with them and you could see the confusion on their face. And they would look back at me and say, you mean my purpose is to live for God? I would say, no. I mean, I hope you do live for him. The implication is if he's your purpose, I hope you do live for him. But what if you suffer a stroke in life later in your life and there's nothing you can do for him besides just receive care and lay in a hospital bed? What if that happens? If you say my purpose is to live for God, to like do things for God, then that even that can be stripped from you. And it is for many people. What about children who have very little to contribute? Does that mean their life does not have purpose because they're not contributing anything? So our world sees meaning and purpose and value in people who contribute. That's how we understand things. We name streets and cities after people who contributed great things, who, you know, accomplished a lot in their life. And so when I say my purpose is a person, your purpose is a person, there is a lot of confusion. And that makes sense to me. Because then the answer, the question is, well, what does that even mean, right? What does it even mean to be made for a person? I think there's a few implications of that, but they're all very difficult for us to learn. There's a lot of detoxing from doing that I think we have to do. We're so accustomed to feeling like our days matter and our lives matter if we can do things and accomplish things and see results, that then to go, my life exists for a person. It's a detox from that type of evaluation. So just here's one example from my own day. If my purpose is a person, then that means my life is more about doing, I mean, more about knowing than doing. Because if my purpose is a person, then knowing that person matters preeminently. And I think you see that in the, you know, the greatest commandment. Jesus asked multiple times, what's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He gives us that from day one. This is most important. Love me, not do for me, not achieve for me, just know me and love me. And that will require your energy with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. He's letting us know that takes work. But that work in my day looks very unimpressive, because that means I have to stop doing to know him, sit quietly wherever I choose to do that, in my home or at a coffee shop or in my car, and talk to him. I have to pray and I have to listen to him to have a relationship. So to read his word and give time to that, to understand, do I even understand what this is saying to me, what it means? I have to be able to listen quietly for him. The psalmist will say, I wait in silence on the Lord. He is my hope. All of that takes a lot of time. All of it feels very blah. And that sounds maybe sacrilegious, but that's what I know from talking to people who are like, it feels so boring. We're so used to the quick paced. Oh, I did this. I did that. I'm on social media. I posted these things, to then slow that pace down to where you're in the quiet. You can just sit still. It feels uneventful and boring and plain and simple. And it is. But that's, if I'm made for a person, then that means that becomes priority number one for me. And I have to fight for that and make knowing him the thing that I do. And what's interesting is Jesus, when he is speaking about what makes a life effective in John 15, that's ultimately what he's saying. You are the branch, I'm the vine. And when you abide in me, you bear fruit. But apart from me, you can do nothing. There's a whole lot of doing in the world that's not being done by abiding in Jesus. That means that nothing can look really shiny and pretty and really effective, but it is still nothing in God's eyes. And that also means something. Effectiveness can look very probably plain and simple to us. He essentially just says, stay with me. Abide just means stay with me, stay close to me. If you just stay close to me, he assures us that our life will bear fruit. That means that's that quiet sitting, that boring moment of I'm going to pause my doing to know the one I was made for is going to make an impact. And we don't, there's faith in that, right? We can't always see that, but it is a promise that is a type of connecting to the vine that will one day lead to all the things that we want, a life of greatness and effectiveness. All those things start there because we are made for a person. I think at the end of the day, when I think about this idea that our purpose is a person, not doing for him, just him, himself, that ultimately means, like John the Baptist, my purpose is to be fully at his disposal. Like, I'm just, Lord, I'm yours. I belong to you. I'm no longer autonomous. You've purchased me with your blood. I am just at your disposal. And everything I do in my life, I'm now called to do with you, to do it in communion with you, and to do it for you. Even if that's eating a sandwich. And he says, eat and drink, whatever you do, do it for the glory of God. The New Testament writers don't look at the significant things in our life and go, do those for the glory of God. Paul picked the most mundane, boring, seemingly ineffective thing in our life, eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, something that like kids do, right? Everybody does it. Do that for the glory of God, that meaning is meant to explode even into those simple daily functioning things, that we do it with him and for him and stay fully yielded to him. And that's what it means, I think, to be, for my purpose to be a person. It doesn't mean we don't do anything. It does mean, though, that we value knowing him and that we stay in a position of all of me and all of my life exists for you. God, you have freedom to do what you please with me and with my life. Mm-hmm. I'm at your disposal. And that's where meaning will explode into our lives.
Yeah, I think we really see this reflected in the scriptures when Jesus himself teaches, you know, people will come to him at the end of time and say they've done this, they've, you know, cast out demons and done some very extraordinary things that, you know, the ordinary believer won't do. And those people who have been so productive in a certain sense will be denied entrance with the statement, I do not know you, you know, that emphasizes that knowing. And I think that this is such an important message inside of the church, because so much of our doing in the church can, as you mentioned earlier, become me actually trying to use God and use spiritual activity, you know, to find or make my own purpose and, you know, sort of prove my value apart from God, you know. And it can overflow even into something like your devotional life, whereby you feel like, okay, I did an hour's worth of devotion every day for this past month. You know, it's going well. I can ask God for big things, you know, because I've been doing my devotions. Whereas that's supposed to be the time where we are just receiving from him and delighting in him and enjoying the fact that we get to know him. So it's really such an important message, even within the church. And then another impact that I really see from this message is that it really stops us from having any ground to boast on before God. Mm-hmm. You know, if our purpose is him, and everything we do is supposed to flow out of that and be for his glory, we really can't boast of any of the activity that he places in our lives. But Kelly, you touch on three unique desires that we have when it comes to our work. The desire for visibility, to be seen, the desire to make an impact, and then the desire to be involved in unique work. Because even though we acknowledge that our purpose is a person, as you mentioned, that doesn't mean that we don't do anything. But finding our purpose in him changes the way we do things. So can you talk about how even those three needs, visibility, impact, uniqueness, are met in God?
We should see our lives full of activity because of being made for a person. It does have to start with, that's not what I was made for, right? But then, like you said, when we're made for him, it actually is what allows us to keep doing with the right amount of energy. If you need your work to be your source of meaning, your work will always feel draining in some sense. When you don't need it, when my work and my activity is not what I need for a sense of validation, then I'm free now to do it with better, more energy. And I think that I used to think those desires to be seen or to make an impact, you know, to do something unique were wrong or sinful. But as I read the Bible and read things that Jesus has to say, I realized, no, he doesn't actually despise those things. We're just misdirected in how we try to get those needs met. Like take the scene, I want to be seen, that feeling for visibility. You know, you see that in children from the day they can speak. Mom, watch me. Look at this. It's just in human beings. It's not a bad thing. But if we're not careful, we will live for the wrong set of eyes. We will just live for one another. things like social media give us access to like an instant audience and a responsive audience that likes things and comments to things. And we can track how many, you know, it's like, it is a cheap substitute for what we were made for. We were made to be seen, you know, but Jesus will say to the people in his day, don't live to be seen by others. But he doesn't just stop there and say, don't live to be seen. Do everything in secrecy. And it doesn't matter who sees you. He doesn't say that. He says, go and pray in your closet or, you know, in hiddenness where your Father in heaven who sees will reward you. So he actually commends living to be seen and living to be seen in a way that there is reward, the same way social media gives us certain rewards of likes and comments and growth. He's looking at us saying, God watches at all things. He's peering over heaven and he searches the earth. You know, the Psalms will say his eyes roam to and fro looking for whose heart's fully devoted to him. God is very attentive to the activities and the affairs done on the earth. And that means all of my life is seen, not just this little sliver that I choose to post. And Jesus actually commends that I would keep that in mind when I walk to my car and it has a flat tire. And in that moment, I do the very hard work of patience, right? And taking a deep breath and not getting angry. Like when I choose to walk in holiness behind the scenes, I'm meant to remember God is watching. The angels are watching. Like people are watching this moment. It matters. And there is reward coming for those of us who walk rightly in hiddenness. And it's good for me to think about that. It's actually good to keep in mind I'm seen. And not just that some of my work is seen, but all of it is seen. How I choose to clean my kitchen later today when no one is watching matters because God is watching. And he's told me to do it for his glory. Working as hard for him is not for man. Or the same thing, like wanting to make a difference, wanting to leave an impact. Gosh, all of us want that. We want our lives to matter. We want to know that our existence like actually resulted in something, you know, that something came from our lives. I think that is a good desire, but we tend to only assess impact in very numerical, visible ways that are associated with things we can see in this life. But again, going back to John 15, Jesus is for our producing fruit. You know, He's actually interested in our lives being fruitful. He's for that. He designed it that way, which is why he's saying things like, just, I want you to stay close to me because it's as you stay close to me that impact will come from your life, that fruit will come, that real effects on your life and others will happen because you're connected to me. And what's good about that is Jesus is essentially taking on the responsibility of producing the impact through us. He sees himself as the source of that, right? He's the vine. He's just saying it's really a beautiful arrangement that he's just in some ways just rest, stay close to me. And through your resting in me, your connection to me, I'm promising you the branch will bear so much fruit that I'll have to prune it back to strengthen it so that it can bear more fruit in the future. He's really the one doing the heavy lifting. And as long as I stay close to him, there is assurance it will produce fruit. We just won't see that fully until after our lives. You know, a lot of the lives that have left the biggest impact, we know their impact after that person has passed. You know, all these books are written about people in posts, right? It's like, oh, now we see the long lasting effects of people like Martin Luther King Jr., you know, or Billy Graham or other certain huge historical figures. Like, yes, we saw a little bit in their life, but we see the ripple effects far after. And I don't need to concern myself with how much impact, but just to know for certain, so long as I stay connected to him, he's just assuring me there will be impact. It will happen. Just trust me that I'm doing it in my time and in my way. And you might not see it this side of heaven. But he's as interested in our impact as we are and more so. And it's the same thing with uniqueness that, you know, I think we want this, a unique purpose, a unique calling. It's like, what can only I do? And we see that in such a narrow way. Like, I used writing as an example, right? I might say, well, only I can write these types of books. It's like, well, gosh, I put so much pressure on that one part of my life. And then everything else is just blah, like doesn't matter. But what is amazing is I think what you see, in the scriptures, and as you really think about it, it's not just certain skill sets that I have that are unique. It's really the whole of my life that's utterly unique. Mm-hmm. Paul says, you know, in the book of Acts, in one of his sermons, that he has strategically placed and people in time and space and in different places on the earth and in times on the earth so that people would seek God. Mm-hmm. So he's put me here. I live in Texas, right? On this street, in this house, with these kids, with these neighbors, with all of these things. All of that is so utterly unique. No one else has the life that I have. No one else has the life that you have. And God has orchestrated that to allow people to seek him, us and others. Every interaction I have is so utterly unique because only I am there to do it. Only I am the neighbor having the conversation mm-hmm. with that person outside of our driveways. You know, only I am talking to that person that I work with. And that I think is so much more liberating to think about than just go, well, there's this one little thing that only I can do. It's like, no, everything in my life is something mm-hmm. only I can mm-hmm. do. God is really interested in our unique contribution, mm-hmm. but it's much broader than a specific set of tasks we mm-hmm. might bring to the table. It's really the whole of our lives that are unique that he wants to use. And I see in all of those ways, him just meeting my deep need for those things mm-hmm. to be seen, to make an impact, to do something unique. He really cares about that. He's just doing it in a different way than the world does mm-hmm. or than maybe we would like sometimes. But he's not against the desire. The mm-hmm. desire is good.
Yeah, I found in your book, especially as you were writing about this aspect of unique work, that people crave to do something that's like speciality work, novel to them, that there was quite a lot of resistance to that specific concept from the people that you were interviewing for the book.
Yes.
It seems like that was the one that there was a lot of fear surrounding that. Fear that if I, you know, don't have a unique purpose, then I might as well not even exist because my purpose is so linked to my identity. But I love how you bring out this aspect that the uniqueness is not in your purpose. We all have the same purpose, you know, mm-hmm. but the uniqueness is in how God has chosen to use you wherever mm-hmm. he has placed you. And that's once again, just taking the immense pressure off of us, mm-hmm. Knowing that the unique thing that God is asking me to do is something that he set in place. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's something that he's prepared me for. He's put it in front of me. And I love how you touch on the fact that some of the things that are unique to us are so mundane, you mm-hmm. know, but only you are the mother to your specific set of kids. Mm-hmm. That's the example that you use in the book. You're, mm-hmm. that you are the mother to that specific set of children and nobody else can do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kelly, thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated it. I think the message of this book is so necessary because, as you mentioned, it brought so much peace to your life. Mm-hmm. And it really has the power to bring that peace to the readers and listeners of the book because the message is just so true that if we find our purpose in God, as you mentioned, everything takes on a new color.
Yes.
If I could just ask you to touch on how do we go about practically modeling this purposeful life, for example, to your children. How do you change the narrative in their minds to convey to them that also for them, the same is true, that it's not their actions that bring them purpose?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can model this for our kids or for anyone in our lives a few ways. One is to just be careful about how we talk about our activities and specifically what we celebrate. What we celebrate is communicating something to others. It's communicating value. So if the only thing I celebrate in my kids' lives is some like, oh, you won the soccer game, you know, which is special and important, or you passed this test, or you were able to perform at school and do this thing. Yes, I should celebrate those things. But when I see one of my kids choose to apologize to a sibling on their own, it's like I stop, go, whoa, you lived for God in this moment that very few other people saw. That's huge. That is so impactful. You have no idea what impact that's going to make on your sibling's life or what that's doing in your own heart. Jesus just gained ground in your heart as you humbled yourself. That's amazing. You know, or when I have a company that will come and clean our house occasionally because we have five kids and I need help. And I will, when they leave, like I will, when that, this company that we've hired leaves, I will bring my kids along. Go, guys, this group of ladies has so helped our family. Mm-hmm. Think about all the ways they've just enabled me to have time with you or to do this thing. And I will just celebrate that and say, this is what a great contribution that they're making to our home and so many other homes to just help that place be flourishing in a place of hospitality. So as I celebrate those things, I'm communicating something to my kids of what matters. And we tend to only celebrate certain things. And I'm just trying to broaden that. How do I talk about my life and about theirs? And what do I celebrate and help them see worth and value in it? And I need to make sure it's not just a certain set of activities, but all things, even rest, even taking a day off when we Sabbath together as a family. It's like, this matters. We're reminding our hearts, God doesn't need us to do anything to be pleased with us. It's not when we contribute things that we have value. We have value even when we don't do anything and we stay in pajamas all day, you know, because we exist for God and for his purposes. And if he tells us to rest, then in our resting, we honor him. So, and I think for friends too, we can do that. There's times where, I've been at a baby shower or a wedding shower, and there's a few, quite a few single women in my life who are in their 30s and would really like to be married. And when they are at a wedding or, you know, I just know that's hard. It's hard to rejoice with others who are getting something that you want. And I'll pull them aside and just commend them. I see you right now, how you're celebrating this sister in Christ when I know that your heart is probably aching. And that's really hard work. And it's happening in the privacy of your heart and no one else sees it, but it glorifies God. Like, I'm just trying to celebrate this hidden moment. So it can even branch outside of our families. But again, we should celebrate all of those things as an expression of you're walking with God in the hiddenness of your own heart. And that is valuable. God sees it. We're highlighting that visibility. It's impactful. It's going to produce fruit in your life and others in ways that we could only dream. It's unique. Only you have this story that God has put you in and you're walking it with him. And you might not be able to see it, but this is going to leave a legacy of impact behind you. You don't know who's watching you. You don't know what's going on, but God is in charge of your story and you're walking faithfully with him in it. So I think that's really important. And I'm also, even with my kids, trying to ask different questions than things like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And instead of trying to, you know, that just ends up us picking random things that seem cool to us, right, out of the sky. I want to be an astronaut. It's like very few of us will be astronauts, let's be honest. But I'll ask them instead, you know, what is giving you joy? What does God put in your life that's giving you joy, that you're good at, that you are seeing be helpful to others? Or I'll sometimes notice things that they're good at doing and try and highlight that in connection with the community around them. Kind of just that idea of, you know, uniqueness. One of the chapters in the book is called Ordinary Actions in the Hands of an Extraordinary God, that really it's God who's the extraordinary one planning, you know, all of these unique things around us. But I'll try and help my kids see, what do you think God's up to in your life? And what might you contribute to the community around us? It's not just what do you want to be, but how can you match your own things that God has put in you to the needs of others around you? What might God be doing? And try and make it less about their own self-actualization. You know, what big thing do you want to achieve? It's not about that. You don't need to achieve anything to be to have a purposeful life. You know, I think that's the subtle message being conveyed there. It doesn't matter if you achieve anything great. You might be, one of my kids for a while was like, I think I want to clean houses for a living. And I was like, awesome. I love that. That's just like we talked about the people that help us. That's such a contribution to homes and to communities. Or do you want to deliver the mail? Like, could that be something that you see as valuable? So it's not about achieving something great. It's about how can I use my life to bless others and walk with God? And I'm trying to help them think differently about that, which is very countercultural, right? The world around us is like, what's the highest mountain we could climb and achieve? But it's like, but if everybody does that, then we can't function as a society because someone has to do the basics. Someone has to run the grocery store. Someone has to farm the food. Someone has to do those things. And they're valuable because we can't live without those things. And so I'm trying to help my kids see how communities function and what their role might be in it, unless, you know, what do you want to be and do and achieve? It's like, you don't need to achieve to be okay. You are God's and you exist to reflect him. And you can do that anywhere, in cool looking ways or in mundane ways. And he may lead you to do both. Mm. We just got to stay open-handed to him and walk with him in it.
I really love the question that you mentioned. What do you think God might be up to in your life? Because I really think that perspective helps to shift the narrative in the sense of who is the real protagonist in the story.
Yes.
So I love that.
Absolutely.
Kelly, thank you so much. One thing that I really must say that your book has helped me to realize is that even in Jesus' work, you know, of redeeming us, dying for us, accrediting us with his righteousness, you've just opened my eyes to the fact that that was done so that God could bring me back into my purpose to know him. You know, that our sin separates us from our true purpose of knowing him. And through Christ, you know, we are able to connect back with God and, you know, to find our true purpose and to start living out of that. So thank you so much for your effort in learning these lessons. You did the heavy lifting for us. You went through the long season of, you know, struggling with God and obviously then writing the book. Thank you so much for sacrificing your time to share this message with us.
Thank you so much, Larice. Thanks for letting me have this conversation with you. And it's been so fun.
Well, I hope that you were encouraged and equipped by our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining Kelly Needham and myself for Woman Today. For more good news, you can head on over to our website at gncr.org.za, and I am available as Larice Faree on either Facebook or Instagram, so please feel free to reach out to me on either of those platforms. I will see you again next week. Thank you so much for your time. Bye.